Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and you are listening to episode 203. That shouldn't be as hard as it was to say. We are very happy to have with us for the first time somebody that you might have recognized if you've been to Toronto Comic Con or Fan Expo Canada as one of the main moderators. He is a writer at popmythology.com, as well as many other different websites. If you want to get into anything geek culture, you might find his writing there, as well as being a English and history teacher in the city of Toronto. I am very happy to have with us Mr. John Kirk. John, thanks for coming to the show. How are you doing?
Fantastic, Eric. Thanks very much for having me. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Every time I go to Fan Expo or Toronto Comic Con, I look forward to the panels that you moderate, because you give it a touch of class. I don't know if it's the English accent or just the appreciation that you have for the works of the writer or artist that you are going to be moderating for, and I've always found them very informative, so thank you for that. I enjoy your panels very much. Not everybody is a great moderator, so just thought you should know that.
Well, that's very flattering. Thanks very much. But, you know, my job is basically just, you know, to make the guests feel comfortable and look good on stage, because, I mean, even though their talent may speak for themselves, sometimes it's difficult to, you know, get them to talk about themselves, and you just really want to make them feel welcome and have a great time. So it's all about respect.
Yeah, absolutely. How did you get into moderating panels for Fan Expo and Toronto Comic Con?
Well, it was, that's a good question, actually. I think basically because I happened to be in the right spot at the right time, and I happened to know one of the guests, and I'm trying to remember which was the first one that I did, but I think it was just basically one of those circumstances where everything fell in the right place, and speaking to Kevin, of course, it was, well, do you know about such and such and so and so, and I happened to know about such and such and so, and he went, well, do you want to do this and that? And so after such and such and so and this and that, there I was.
Yeah, that serendipity of right place, right time is so important, right?
Yeah, and again, I just have a passion for this stuff that it was a joy, actually. It's one of those jobs that you know, the old expression that if you know, you find something to work at that you love, and you'll never work a day in your life, this is one of those circumstances. And, you know, one panel turned into three, and three turned into, you know, six, and then last Toronto Comic Con, I ran pretty much the entire celebrity side, which was a bit of a juggling match, but it was, you know, again, it was just one of those things that you come away from with such a great high. Like speaking to Ron Perlman, sitting next to Ron Perlman, you know, I'm like, I'm sitting next to frickin' Hellboy,
right? And Beauty and the Beast, or Beast from Beauty and the Beast, right?
Oh yeah, and of course, you know, all, like we talked about so many things, like Sons of Anarchy, and of course Quest for Fire. Mm-hmm. And like the guy's got such a huge range that, I mean, I've seen every single thing that this guy's done. Yeah. And it all just hit me on stage at once. And I was just glad that I didn't wind up, you know, bubbling over with excitement and enthusiasm. Although I did have a smile on my face for about, you know, 3 days afterwards.
So. Has there ever been a moment when you've been moderating one where that fan can't help itself and it comes out of you and you're like, oh, tone it down, John, and you gotta keep yourself composed here?
Yeah, actually, let's see. It was last Comic-Con. It was March, and I like to do a lot of research for my panels.
Okay.
And you know, it usually takes like about, you know, 40 hours in advance, and there was one opportunity. So we had they had the entire cast of or at least three actors from Sons of Anarchy, And so they had Ron Perlman, and I'm trying to think of the other two. One of them canceled. Oh, and I'm missing one. Help me out, please. From Scotland.
Oh, man, what show are they a part of? They're from Sons of Anarchy? Man,
Sons of Anarchy, yeah, Chibs.
Was it the one that was also in Pacific Rim?
Gladiator.
Rain? Oh, Gladiator. Okay.
Yeah, he was in Gladiator. He has a scar, and you may have to edit this out.
That's okay. No problem. Hey, this is all cool. We can't remember everything.
I know, and it's driving me nuts now because it's such a great story. What's his name?
I'm going to look it up. You keep telling me the story. I'm going to look up his name.
Okay, so basically, what had happened is, you know how he's got a scar on his face, right?
Tommy Flanagan. And there you go.
Tommy Flanagan, thanks. So he's got a scar on his face, and so they said to me in preparation, whatever you do, don't bring up the scar. And I said, okay, well, you know, I can buy that for sure, not a problem. And the thing is, because he's from Glasgow, and I'm originally from Scotland, my accent came out, you know, a little bit when I was in, you know, when I was sitting next to him. And so I welcome, you know, so everybody, it's Tommy Flanagan, welcome to the stage. And he goes, oh, all right. And I said, well, here you go then, son. And he goes, oh, yeah, you're from Scotland there, eh? And I was like, yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, that's where he goes. And he goes, oh, where you hail from? And I'm like, I'm from Dunfermline. And he goes, oh, Dunfermline. Oh, I'm from Glasgow. And I went, oh, I know Glasgow well, son. My mom's from Saki Hall Street. And he goes, Saki Hall Street. You don't ken, eh? And he goes, oh, yeah, you know that. So we lapse into that Scottish brogue. And he goes, Saki Hall Street. That's where I got my scar. You want to hear about it?
Perfect. There you go.
And exactly. And at that point, it was just like, okay, you know, I let the enthusiasm get away from me, but it turned into like such a fun moment at that point, because he basically talked about not just the scar and how traumatic it was, but how instrumental it was actually in allowing him to discover acting. Mm-hmm. And that became the gateway, because while he was recuperating, there was a theater not too far from the hospital, and he wound up getting to see shows, and there were classes, and then he, you know, started to do drop-ins, and he started to get into it while he was healing, and that basically, and then when Mel Gibson, I believe, was filming over there, that's how he got his start, and it was just one of those great moments where, you know, even though I was enthusiastic and it got away from me, it turned into something that I think the audience really enjoyed.
Yeah, no, I think that goes to show the value of finding common ground off of the hop with people, right? Because when you do, they let their guard down and they will give you a little bit more than when you probe, I guess. And you get into that maybe obvious question, it made him want to share it with you as opposed to you thinking, don't ask it, because that could be distracting too, right? Whatever you do, don't ask about it. That's awesome.
Well, and it turns into, like I said, it's all about that respect, right? Mm-hmm. Because another great moment was, and this is about a couple of years ago, it was John Wesley Shipp from The Flash.
Right.
Well, you know, he played The Flash originally too, right?
Yes.
So he just didn't play The Flash's dad. He was, you know, he was also The Flash in a previous one-season show. But what I like to do is I really like to research the background. And sometimes I'm fortunate enough to talk with him ahead of time.
Oh, okay.
You know, and that way I can, you know, I can bring up subjects that are permitted and subjects that, yeah, let's just stay away from that one.
Right.
And, but John Wesley Shipp actually has a really interesting family background. And his dad was a minister during the 1960s in the States, in the South, during, you know, the racial unrest.
Okay.
And he was a proponent of integration of congregations. So he wanted his congregation to be welcomed. He wanted his congregation to feel, you know, like they were like children of God, basically, and then there was no judgment to whatever color,
right,
whatever creed, whatever background, everybody was welcome. And because he was a man of God, he believed in that like to his core.
Right.
And basically, because of that, not only did he lose his job, because the deacons of the church basically went against that and you know, basically, you know, sacked him, they his family, and John Wesley Shipp remembers this, basically were the target of violence. So, like, one night their windows were shot out, there were bricks thrown, their house was basically, you know, vandalized and terrorized, and it became the center of a huge investigation, and it was all basically in response to his father's insistence upon, you know, that congregation that he saw. And because of that, he was recognized, and he was awarded like civic awards, basically, you know, on the basis of you know, what sort of a character. And so I brought that up in the moderation, and John paused and he went, "Wow, I didn't know you were going to bring that up."
Hmm.
And I started to get a little bit nervous at that point, and I took his hesitation for, you know, discomfort and, oh, I've done something wrong here, and I started to get a bit nervous, and then I looked at his face, and he was quite emotional, and he told the story from his perspective, you know, adding details that I didn't have access to, and then, you know, the audience went silent, and he looked at me and he said, "Why did you bring that up?" And it was like one of those moments that you couldn't have planned for, even though I did. But, you know, it was, yeah, just one of those great moments that just, you know, came up. And I said, "Well, I just thought it was appropriate because you play a hero on TV, and you've been the father of a hero, but in real life, your father was the hero."
Right.
And I just wondered if that had any effect on your performance. And the audience at that point just went wild, and I've, you know, never seen, and it was a full room, so there was a thunderous applause. In fact, I've got a picture of that that moment, because he took his cell phone and he took a picture of me with the audience in, you know, in the background, and he came up to me, he made a really big fuss of me afterwards, and he said, "You know, you really, really nailed it with that." He said, "Nobody's ever brought that up before, and, you know, it was just such a special, special moment, and thank you for letting that story come out." And it's, you know, it, those are the rewards. Like, when you have a panel like that, like, going back to your earlier question, like, how'd you get into this? And, mm-hmm. and you know, it's that sort of pleasure. It's an addiction. It really is, because when you make that guest look as good as they possibly can, that's, you know, that's the goal. And it's such a rush. It is such a high. It's the greatest feeling to come away from a moderation with that sort of a reception.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, when people ask me when I started the podcast, they're like, "Well, what are you starting? What's your end game? Are you trying to make money off of it?" And I said, my main goal is to hopefully one day moderate a panel at one of these shows, because of that same thing that you described, that feeling just when you get to talk to a person who's created something. And I heard someone say before, if there is somebody who's created something or written something that was important to you, and you get the chance to meet them at one of these shows, tell them, let them know. Because when, yeah, when you're sincere about it and you really mean it, not just because you're fanning out or you want the signature of a book that, you know, may hold some value, when they see that you mean it, it really makes their day. You can see it in their eyes, and it makes their job worth it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? So there is no better feeling, I don't think, than being gracious to others. So when you get to do that on a level where an audience can now appreciate somebody else's work, that's very important for the experience of that weekend. You leave that weekend having been transformed in a way. So I totally get that addiction. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I think also sometimes the audience isn't really good at expressing, you know, questions, and so, you know, there's also like, you are the bridge, mm-hmm. You are the conduit, that, you know, your questions basically come first, because you're giving the audience a chance to think of something that is not only, you know, relevant but also respectful, right. And so that I usually divide up the moderation into three parts. So we do like a little intro, then I'll lob some questions at the guest, and they're questions that I've researched, and you know they're pretty safe, and then at that point we turn it over to the audience, and I think one of the best examples of that is John Rhys-Davies. John Rhys-Davies is a true showman. And I mean, he's old school actor, so of course he didn't want to sit down. He stood up in his panel, and I asked a couple of questions, but he asked me if you know we could just riff with it and just be relaxed, because he gets a lot of the same questions, obviously, like what was it like to voice Treebeard and act Gimli at the same time, and he not only has these great answers, but they're really flamboyant and very dramatic, and he's a show in himself just to hear him answer those questions that he's already answered before in the past, right? So I threw a few questions in there that I wanted to ask, but the way that he presented himself, the audience, you know, just fed off his energy and they followed his lead. Right. So me, I was just happy to share the stage with him at that point.
Right. I think one time I remember that happening, I think you were the moderator, was when Greg Capullo took the mic and just went into the audience and was, you know, shaking everybody's hand that he met, and the comfort of the room and the stories that he was telling was wonderful. Like, he was such a great guy.
Oh, yeah. And Greg is one of those big-hearted dudes, and he's like he's got a code, right? Like, he has a behavioral code. He's got a respectful code, and you know, like he knows his limits. He knows what he's going to do. But the way that he interacts with his fans,
yeah,
you couldn't find a more welcoming, understanding, respectful guy. And you can tell. You know, the measure of a guy's character by the way he treats people around him.
Absolutely.
And you know, he's a loving dad. He's a good husband.
Yeah.
He's got a strong work ethic. Like, that's the guy that's probably one of his biggest values right there is the importance of a good work ethic.
Right.
And I think he communicated that in that panel. I remember that one. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. It was so refreshing to see somebody who, you know, especially at that time, I think he was just getting off of the Batman run with Scott Snyder, and he was definitely, he embodies that sort of image of a rock star, so people kind of look at him as that, you know, that rock star cool kind of person, and then when you see him break down those barriers, and he's so, you know, affectionate about his wife and his family, like, it was such a warm room with this guy who looks like heavy metal personified, right? So it was such a cool dichotomy of a man who embodies all of those things that you described. It's so true.
Well, and just to, you know, just to give you an idea of how open and how welcoming he is. I was at MegaCon a couple of years ago, and I was moderating some panels there. Chris Claremont and Greg Rucka and so I go downstairs to the pool area, because I've got about, you know, an hour or so to just write some notes. And I look over, and it's not a populated area, which is kind of weird. There weren't a lot of guests, but I look over, and there's Greg Capullo. And so I move away because, you know, he's talking to somebody, and I don't want to interrupt. And I figure, but, you know, I'll just keep an eye on him. And when he leaves, I'll just walk up and just say hi. But I'll give him his space. So I go to sit down. I put my stuff down. I order a drink. And I look up, and all of a sudden, there's Greg, and he's waving at me. And he goes, "Hey, Captain Kirk, come on over here." And I'm like, okay, this guy, cool. Like, I moderated his panel a year before. It's, you know, he remembers my nickname. That's great, you know. And I go over, and I go, "Hey, Greg, it's nice to see you." And he goes, "Ah, it's good to see you, man." And he goes, "Oh, do you know my friend? This is Todd McFarlane." And I went, "Yeah, I'm, you know, familiar with your work,
heard of him before, you know." Yeah.
And he goes, "Well, why don't you sit down, have a drink with us?"
Wow, that's awesome.
And I'm sitting at the same table with Todd McFarlane and Greg Capullo, and I think Metal. They were just working on the cover for Metal, and so he was telling Todd about it, and he said, "Well, why don't you get Captain Kirk to look at it?" And he showed it to me. He showed me the prelim for the cover of Metal, and I was like, "It needs to be in color." And Todd looks at me and says, "Yeah, you got to color that." And I just realized at that point, maybe I changed the cover of Metal. Like, did I just do that?
It's so funny to get into those circles. Yeah. What could happen?
and actually, I was playing with the idea of maybe, you know, seeing if I could buy that. But that was but that's Greg. Like, he was just, you know, "Yeah, sure, come on over, sit down," and just open and respectful and nice, and just the type of guy that you could just ease into a conversation with. Yeah. You know, with Todd McFarlane sitting at, you know, at the table. So yeah.
I found that Todd McFarlane was like that himself at the last Fan Expo. He made it a point to say hello to everybody who walked into his panel, which was pretty cool. Because a lot of times, you never know when a celebrity is around, how aloof they may be, or you know, not even do that well with big crowds. Not everyone does well with big crowds, but for him to be so, you know, we know he's gregarious and energetic. All those image guys tend to kind of have that about them, but for him to make it a point to say hello to everybody, that was really cool. So it kind of makes sense that, you know, Todd and him are cut from the same cloth in a way.
Yeah, and Todd's very nice to talk to as well, and you can tell, yeah. Like, I mean, they have that shared value, mm-hmm. And I have this great selfie that I just forwarded to you.
Okay, I'm gonna take a look at it.
And it was just a great moment. But again, I think, yeah, it just comes down to giving your guests respect, making them feel welcome, mm-hmm. being, you know, concerned about, you know, their comfort level, and doing your research, and that, you know, it goes far in helping people remember you, I guess.
That's a cool picture. I'm just taking a look at it right now. People can't see it, but I might use it as the picture for the episode, if you don't mind.
Oh, that's sure. Yeah, yeah.
So,
but yeah, that was fun. As long as they get equal credit because they all took the photos. So.
Yeah, no problem. So I want to go back to the beginning a little bit. I know, everyone tends to ask these questions, but what made you fall in love with the medium of comic books, or even just geek culture in general? Because I know all across the board you are, you know, not necessarily a historian, but the word's going to come to me. But go ahead, tell me the story about how you got into this.
If you really want to go back, I think it was because I was just one of those kids who was really turned on by imagination. Mm. And you know, imagination comes out in so many different ways, like, you know, The Wizard of Oz, Lord of the Rings, you know, and like, it's the representations of imagination that really seem to stick with me were the things like Star Wars, Star Trek, you know, comic books. My first comic book was, I was 4 years old living in Dunfermline, Scotland, and I owned the first copy of 2000 AD.
Wow.
And I remember purchasing that and reading it, and Judge Dredd was my first superhero. Hmm. And you know, is my all-time, long-time favorite superhero. And it was just because geek culture, you know, science fiction, fantasy, superheroes, they represent extremes in imagination. You know, I think Chris Claremont said it really well, like, you know, artists and writers, you know, that's all you need. You just need somebody to tell a story, and then you need somebody to visualize a story. And he can get, you know, John Byrne Silvestri or any of those guys, and he can describe something, but they bring it to life, and they can do it, you know, for, you know, in a 32-page comic book. And Comic books were so accessible. Like movies, you had to pay for, you had to get your parents to take you to, you had to stay up late. But a comic book, you could walk into a news store, you could walk into a grocery store, back when I was a kid, and you could pull a comic book off the rack or the spinner, and for 35 cents, it was yours, and if that was your story. And the reason why people collected comic books, was not because of the inherent value, or not because of the rarity, or because of any of the publishing tricks. It was because it was their story. And the X-Men, the New Mutants, the New Teen Titans, the Avengers, these weren't just stories. These were, representations of imagination that belonged to you. And I think that's what it is for comic collectors, because like if I read, if I go into any of my Marvel Masterworks, or any of my hardcovers, like I have the soft covers sitting in a box and I will not touch them because they're fragile, which is why I love hardcovers now. But I can go back into any of those hardcovers and I can read them. And it's not just, enjoying the adventures. It's for me, it's also going back in time and remembering all the good memories that are associated with those comics. So I think, when I was a kid, and when I was growing up with comics and with culture, I associated them with places where I lived. I associated them with good things, with good people. The characters represented values or characteristics or personalities of people that, I would look for in real life. And it really, comics really did become not just, entertainment in form of imagination, but I think comics also became, a way of looking at the world and figuring it out. And especially with Marvel. I think I was always a Marvel guy, because I think Stan Lee understood what he could do with the power that was available to him. And in fact, we all know about how Stan Lee would, would have Stan's soapbox, and he would say things that that were basically commentaries on society and values that we should all adopt. And that came out in a lot of those titles. Like we learned about prejudice through the X-Men and the New Mutants because of the mutant menace. We learned about acceptance and other lifestyles through Power Man and basically what values Captain America was supposed to stand for. Like all these things, I think if you really loved comics, you took those lessons to heart.
I completely agree with you. You articulated it in a way that I try to share with people as well. The word I was thinking of was a curator of culture. I call Kevin Boyd that as well. Yeah, I think you guys are similar in that way. But you're absolutely right. The for those of us who grew up from a young age with comic books having a connection with them. Like I often say, people who have listened to this podcast before have heard me say, if the house is burning down, there's only one box that needs to be brought with us of my collection, and that's my John Byrne Superman, because that is my earliest memory, visual memory of those things that you're describing, a happy place, a happy time, that level of imagination and excitement. But also, this was before I could read, so I'm looking and understanding story and people and behavior through these different windows, these panels that are giving you a sense of value with, you know that there's words there, and even though you can't read them, you can kind of figure out what's happening in those stories. And the way that you describe that those value systems, because I was going to ask you that actually about what we can learn from comics. Being, how do you ever integrate those things into your classroom? Because I know you kind of treat the art form with a little bit more. I remember when you were talking to John Ostrander a couple years ago, you referenced his work as though this was a classic prose novelist,
Oh, wow.
and I appreciated that so much, because a lot of times, people, you know, they even people that know that I read comic books often say you're reading kid books, like you're still reading coloring books, like they have that sort of pejorative view of it. But
Yeah.
there is a lot to be taken from, you know, Chris Claremont era X-Men. And I think it's informed this generation so much of what we see people fighting for and standing for. I think a lot of it comes from things that were in those comics. Not to say everyone read them, but you can expand. Go ahead.
Well, it's the visual exposition in comics, right? Like, I mean, yeah, I have a comic unit that I love to teach in my English classes. And next year I'm going to be heading into the school library, so I'll be able to, really pursue this with my students in a lot greater detail next year, and I'm looking forward to that. But the great thing about comics is that so this is a bit of a double-edged sword. When you're teaching comics, when you're teaching visual storytelling, you have to take a novel and you have to take a page out and break it down for students and say, okay, so this is exposition, this is description, right? This is narration, this is character dialogue, right? And the only way that you can appreciate what's going on right now is that you have to have everything described to you in text. So the sounds that are being made, the smells, the color of the night sky, that sort of thing. Like all these things have to be described to you. Now, let's look at a comic. And then we look at a comic page, and what I get them to do is list out all the things that are similar. And a great thing to do is obviously with a comic adaptation of a novel, right? So like the classics illustrated are great for this. So you take a page and you show them what like the same moment that's being described in the novel, and then you show them what's being described, and you ask what's missing, and then they'll say, well, the description's missing. Well, no, it's not, because it's been visually described for you. And then at that moment, you see the link. You see them make that connection because they realize that it's being visually explained with pictures, with colors, with shapes, with textures, with distance, with foreground and background. Even the way that the lettering is positioned can add to that description of the story. And so when they do a compare and contrast between the same page in a comic book, not only are they getting a greater sense of the differences between the media, but they're also getting that idea of visual storytelling. And that's probably one of the best moments in my year, is when, I have students that are able to make that leap and make that connection.
Do you think it's a reach to say that there's a psychological value of how you see the world because you've been a comic book reader? Because everything is visual, so the positioning and the composition of these things, the lighting, the body language that you have to also read in a comic book, because sometimes if you miss it, you'll miss a key part of the story. Do you find that it changes our way of communicating with the world, people who understand that comic book language?
I think if you're a comic reader from a young age, I think you've grown up. Like I said, this is the bit of the double-edged sword because once you get used to that visual description, you take it for granted. And so one of the downsides to just really, just reading comics is that you assimilate a lot of information without consciously recognizing it.
Yes, that's true.
So, sometimes you take it for granted. But that's what I really like about young comic book readers, because once you show them that, and so I mean, I started reading, when I was four, because I started reading comics. And at a young age, you're able to understand that flow of the story. You get the left to right sequence, you see the action that's being described, and then when you see that there are like common words that are repeating themselves, you become familiar with those. And then when you start to understand phonics and sounds, then you're able to start, attaching value to those images and letters, and then you become a stronger reader. I think at that point, it's really essential for those young readers to gravitate to just text, so that they don't take that visual storytelling as the dominant form. And then once they master the text, then they're able to move back and forth. I think young comic book readers are probably in the best position to be stronger readers when they're older students, older kids. And that's kind of a power of comics that people take for granted, and they undervalue the importance of comic reading in schools. 30% of this 30% of the student population, or any population, is probably dyslexic. And it's such a prominent thing that doesn't get properly recognized. And it's like, I mean, I think there was a really good documentary that was just released about a month ago about a group of parents who recognize that their kids were dyslexic, but their school district didn't have the necessary means to either treat it or even recognize it. And so they wound up basically saying, reading is a right. Learning to read is a right. And because it's guaranteed by our government, you are being negligent by not, looking after that 30% of the population, and you are denying them the right to read. And so they actually launched a class action suit, and they won. And that had reverberations because now other school districts in the United States, and now it's happening, up here, people are recognizing that, we're not really looking at our young readers well enough. And a combination of phonics, visual imagery is the best way to basically treat our students and to ensure that, they have access to learning and to reading. And I know from my personal experience that because I was given access to comics at a young age, my vocabulary was advanced for my age. I know I was a really good reader by the early school grades, and that helped me, in my education. And I look at my kids now, and I have a young daughter who is dyslexic, but because we've caught her at a young age, and because we've put in the right measures and strictures, and of course I've encouraged her to read comics as well. With guidance and with understanding, now she's a voracious reader. She's just finished the third volume of Harry Potter, and she's moving on to more stuff. So, yeah, comics are so important in education, and in developing literacy.
Yeah, that's
Bit
so
of a long answer there, sorry.
no, I really appreciate it because it's coming from a educator who actually understands the value of teaching people how to read and the effect that a visual medium like comics can have. There's been a couple people who I've worked with whose their kids did not want to read a book and their teachers were concerned about their inability to, not inability to read, but their lack of interest in trying to read. And then they said, I got my daughter comics and she's just ripping through them now because of, I suggested to try just to see, because there's that connection of the picture, but then you get engaged in the story, and in getting engaged in a story, there's an excitement to it. And when you can control the pace of, I think Kurt Busiek said something like that in an interview once, where it's like comics is that medium, unlike movies, that control the pace for you, or even reading a prose novel where you have to do certain things to keep the pace of it going. With comics, you slow time down on that page, and it goes as fast or as slow as you want it to in that moment when people are having a conversation or when there's an action scene. So there was something very special about that connection of using both sides of your brain to read the text and to also understand the picture and the moods that are being set with the colors, because that does, you don't really realize it sometimes, but it has a huge effect on the story being told. So that was a great answer. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's reinforcement, right? Because I mean, you can read something and then you look at the image, and the image reinforces the idea of the text. Have you ever read Understanding Comics?
I have not. I've heard a lot about it
Okay.
though.
Scott McCloud's textbook on Understanding Comics is probably the best book I've ever read for for talking about this sort of thing. However, there's two things about it. First of all, it's incredibly deep. It's really rich. Luckily, the main ideas are, you know, only like 2 pages long, mm-hmm. but they're described in comic form. So this is a textbook about understanding comics mm-hmm. in comic form. And, you know, so he's not only able to put the concept, you know, into descriptive text, but he's also able to reinforce it with visual imagery. And so you're seeing the comic describe how comics should be understood. And it's a brilliant book. And I always use, like, you know, a couple of pages out of it every year just to show my kids, basically, like, this is a guy who understands comics, and he's teaching you in comic form. And so sometimes what we do is we take our textbooks and we'll take our textbooks and break them down into, you know, how would you visually describe this? And again, by switching that understanding of media, you create learners who not only have a better understanding of the media, but are also able to use the media and demonstrate individual, like, inquiry, different perspectives on becoming a textual learner. And this is all a lot of, like, teacher, you know, gobbledygook, but, I mean, there's a real value behind bringing comics into your literacy program as a teacher. And like I said, not a lot of people, you know, really fully appreciate how powerful the medium can be.
Yeah.
Like Tom King, I think when I interviewed Tom King, I said, well, you know, when we were finished, I said, what's the last thing? What would be the big takeaway that you would like everybody to get out of this piece? And he said, I just love comics, man.
He goes, I've heard him say that.
Everything I do, I just love comics. And I mean, you know, Tom King can't be wrong, right?
No. And there's something about the passion of those who do like this medium and the lengths that we go to take it in, to consume it, because it isn't cheap. It yeah. never stops. And, you know, you can read a 6-issue trade paperback in 45 minutes if you, you know, are undisturbed. And it costs you, you know, over $10, $20 to get that. But there's something about it that just keeps you coming back. There's this fulfillment in it. And that love that he describes, I totally understand it. I can't explain it necessarily, but I think you've done a good job in a lot of ways of that feeling you get from the experience of reading a comic book. And the things you associate it with.
I think also too, a lot of the comic creators that I've met, if they've got one thing in common, it's a humility. Like even some of the diehard veterans from, you know, like the 70s and the 80s who are still, you know, still around, like Walt Simonson, like they have such a humility. Like, you know that they love their art, that they love their work.
Yes,
but they don't pursue celebrity. Like it's something that they, you know, oh, okay, all right, yeah. Like they grudgingly accept that they have done this work, and they've heard it all before, right? They've heard, oh, yeah, I remember reading your stuff when I was a kid, and it, you know, it really touched me in different ways, and but I mean, they're still gracious, they're still nice. But I just remember, like dealing with guys like with Walt Simonson, with Jim Shooter, Mike Zeck. Like they love what they do, but at the same time, it's sometimes when they're in the spotlight, it's difficult for them to be there.
Yeah.
So I think the art form, because it has so much work and because it has so much complexity, I think sometimes it teaches also a bit of, like, appreciation for the work it takes to communicate in this form.
Yeah,
and I think that's what I got from Tom King, and he said that to me. He said, I just love comics. Well, yeah, I do too. But then you know that there's, like, the unspoken, no, man, I really love comics.
yeah, the passion is palpable. It's so true, and it comes out in the work and in what they, the stories that they tell. Like, you can, whether or not you like a particular writer's work, you can really tell that Jeff Johns loves this stuff, or Mark Waid really loves this art form. it's you know, it's contagious, and when they talk about it. Speaking of introducing it into a curriculum, what books do you think would be great places for people to either learn or even study a piece of work that comes from the medium of comics?
Well, yeah, I think I got to go by decades too, because like I think earlier on, as I started, I think one of the essential books to read would be the Claremont Byrne, you know, the 1980s X-Men era.
Absolutely.
Because that was like we're talking about so many important things. We're talking about racial prejudice these days, and that's such a current thing, mm-hmm. and it's coming to, you know, such a boiling point, particularly in the U.S. And I think it's being looked at up here. But I think I learned about acceptance of people by seeing how, disenfranchised and how excluded the X-Men were. And you know, even back in the 60s, this was a group of teenagers founded to protect the world from itself, even though they were feared, hated, and reviled by the rest of humanity. And even in the Secret Wars, I mean, it was interesting in the 80s Secret Wars that you had three camps that were set up. Like, you had the Fantastic Four and the Avengers and some of the individual superheroes like Spider-Man all on one side. Mm-hmm. And you had the villains, you had Dr. Octopus and the Wrecking Crew and Dr. Doom and all those, and they were on one side. But there was a third camp with the X-Men. And it always, like, it was something that really stuck in my mind when I read that series when I was a teenager, is that, well, the X-Men are heroes. Why shouldn't they be with the Avengers and the other heroes? And then it comes out, like, I think in issue 4, when, you know, there's suspicion, and, well, we don't know which way the X-Men are going to go. Are they going to join us, or are they going to go to the side of the villains? And as a kid, I remember thinking, they've been around since the 1960s. Like, they're heroes. Like, why can't people understand that? And that, I think, really polarized my desire to look more for the stories about, you know, why the mutants were excluded and hated so much by the rest of society. And then, of course, when they went further in describing Magneto's background as a Holocaust survivor, mm-hmm. That also created like something that I wanted to learn about. And that was something I wanted to study. And then Kitty Pryde, when it was revealed that she was Jewish too, that was, wow, okay, there's a nice tie-in. So I think there's so many great themes about, you know, acceptance and about appreciation for people of all different backgrounds, you know, and that would be a perfect place to begin right there, is to look at the X-Men, because it's such a melting pot of all these ideas that are so talked about, like, right now.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, even in the X-Men, when they splinter off and you've got all of these camps that are their motivations, their ages, the things that they've lived through, like you said with Magneto, your level of understanding people's motivations, it translates later into real life. And it just takes I can't explain it, but recently I've taken a deep dive into the X-Men myself after the Jonathan Hickman runs began with the House of X and Powers of 10, and it made me go back. Cool. And just seeing all of the things that they were, that Chris Claremont and the people who followed him were putting in place, with things like the Legacy Virus and all the different levels of mutants that were fighting within themselves as they were also trying to fight people who were against them. It just, the mirror image of that with what's happening in the world is so informative. And to be able to teach that to young people or even to older people in that format, and then you step away from it and kind of compare and contrast, you're like, okay, I don't see things necessarily the way I thought I did, because I'm cheering for the X-Men here, so why am I feeling this way in real life about things?
Right.
So it does have that effect.
I think one of the great things about comics, too, is that, again, going back to the way that we read, like, you can you can take a 20-page, 24-page comic, and you can look at it quickly, read it, and then you can go back, and then you can assimilate those ideas at your own pace.
Right.
And you can ask yourself, what do I think about them? Mm-hmm. And in as much as the X-Men taught me about, you know, acceptance and about exclusion, I think, you know, things like the 1980s run on Star Wars comics.
Mm-hmm.
Taught me about basically what's possible to do with you know, different franchises. So I mean, this is a bit of a different way of like a different topic of you know, why you would introduce comics. But I think in terms of like human characteristics and values, I mean, the X-Men would be perfect for that. But for like examining storytelling and you know, riffing off an existing franchise, you look at those. Look at those Marvel comics that came out in like 1978, 1979, all the way up to 80. With you know, with going back to Walt Simonson, like Walt Simonson's run on Star Wars. These are days when they didn't know about Empire Strikes Back,
right.
So they were just trying to fill in stories. And Simonson, I remember him telling me that they had to actually run their stories past Lucasfilm. Before they were published, because in some cases they actually got it right.
Right. I heard the story.
Yeah. So they you know there was one time they had the heroes on an ice planet, and you know they had to be really really. Apparently, there was like a lot of direction coming from Lucasfilm that oh well you know you can't have this because of stuff that we're not allowed to tell you. So. You know, in terms of like you know, reaching the extremes of imagination and creative storytelling and creative writing, those would be excellent comics to bring into a classroom as well. But there's so many things that you could just like. It just comes down to you know what it is that you are about to teach. Like if you want to teach about history, you want to teach about you know World War II, for example. Then you know you do Sergeant Rock.
Right.
You know, you look at Sergeant Rock, you look at Enemy Ace, because Enemy Ace by Joe Kubert is one of those books that, I mean, the hero is a German World War I fighter pilot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what an unlikely hero, what an unlikely place to tell a story is from the side, you know, of, you know, history's bad guy.
Right.
Like, I mean, the Germans in World War I were the enemy, right? They were defeated. But why would you tell a story from that point of view? Well, because it opens up so much history. And it creates questions. And you know, you can bring in any comics, basically. But and there's always, like, some sort of historical reference. There's always some sort of, illusionary reference to literature, a historical thing that's going on. I mean, you look at so many skylines in the United in New York in comics, and you know they include the World Trade Centers, and now that's gone. That's history. So comics are not just great for like storytelling, and not just great for you know like talking about human values, but they're also great about bringing up literary references, film references, character references. There's just a treasure trove of what you can do with them.
Yeah. It's so true when you read a lot of stuff from the 80s, because I enjoy a lot of 80s comics and the stuff that they reference, or sometimes the movies that they have on the marquee and in behind of a fight scene. It's always fun to kind of to see what was on the minds of people at that time who were writing or drawing those books.
Well, when they do the presidents, like
yeah,
you have
yeah.
you know, in DC comics, you'll see you know Ronald Reagan, you know,
yeah.
or you'll see Jimmy Carter, and like in yeah, there was an Avengers issue when the Beast is on monitor duty.
Yeah.
And there's a call from Jimmy Carter. He's like, "Mr. Beast, I declare that there was supposed to be an Avenger on duty at all times." And they actually like, represent his Southern accent, and it's just hilarious.
Right. No, it's great.
It's like, that's dated.
A quick question for you. How are you doing for time? Just don't want to overwhelcome my stay here.
Well, until the wife actually knocks on the door and says your supper's... I ordered out, so I mean, they have supper, they're eating, so
okay.
I should be good to go for a little bit more.
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure. Speaking of 80s comics, what were some of your favorites, things that stand out for you? Because I know you've said that you're a big fan of that era.
Yeah, like, I mean, well, I've already mentioned, you know, my love of the X-Men.
Yeah.
And being able to interview and moderate Chris Claremont, like, about four times, was one of those, you know, enthusiastic moments.
Yeah.
So obviously the X-Men, the New Mutants, I had a really big love for the New Mutants because, I mean, they were contemporary. They were my age, and they were kids, you know, who had superpowers. And but at the same time, they were not just trying to figure out their superpowers. Even though that was a huge dimension of the storytelling, they were also trying to just, you know, figure out life, just like, you know, like the rest of us. And in fact, when the Marvel Superheroes role-playing game came out, I remember my friends and I in high school, we created a scenario in which, you know, we role-played ourselves as New Mutants. And so that was fun. Teen Titans was a huge thing as well, just simply because of the realism of the storytelling. Like it was different from a lot of the other DC comic titles. Like, I've always maintained that the big difference between DC and Marvel is that in DC, the heroes were legendary, epic proportions. You know, they could, you know, move suns, lift planets, that sort of thing. But you've got somebody like Peter Parker who's worried about, you know, where his rent check's coming from.
Right.
Like, they were more relatable. But if you wanted, like, something that was just pure fantasy, you couldn't be Aryan Lord of Atlantis. And like, Jan Duursima is just such a gifted artist, and I remember falling in love with every stroke, like every pencil stroke that she put into her art. Lady Chian and Aryan, it was just, that was a comic book that I just I couldn't put down. And I still have those, you know, from when I was a kid. So those definitely. But then there was, like, Captain Britain, and I had to go back to Captain Britain as one of my favorite heroes because, you know, I was from Britain. So, and he was one of those heroes too that was developed basically to get that British market, and so when they exported Marvel Comics, I mean, they were able to actually produce their own Marvel hero over there, and that was a really cool look at 80s Britain. And then when 80s comics got, you know, Vertigo and more serious, you know, titles like Hellblazer, like, there's that one, I think it's a three-issue arc where John Constantine is, you know, he's been diagnosed with terminal cancer. I don't know if you've read this one. But
No, I
it's
haven't.
amazing because the first issue, it's about him accepting the fact that he's going to die, and it kind of follows those stages of grief, right? So, I mean, basically, he goes through that acceptance, and then, you know, the next stage, he's like, no, I'm not going to accept this at this point, and it's like, you know, I'm going to fight. And then the third issue is basically how he manages to trick, like, the three lords of hell into curing his cancer by selling his soul three times to each of them. And the problem is that if they collect the soul, they have to go to war. And if they go to war, it destabilizes hell, and the other side wins. And that's just such a masterful piece of storytelling that it makes you appreciate not only the cunning of the character, but, you know, the range, the extreme that they were going to take him. I think that was Alan Moore, if I remember correctly. I might be wrong, but again, but then, yeah, you got to see guys like Alan Moore. You got to see, you know, John Byrne. You got to see, you know, Art Adams. I mean, those guys coming up in the 80s, they were champions. They really were.
Yeah.
It was just beautiful to see.
It feels like it's not to be disparaging at all to any of the current people working in comics doing wonderful work or any of the other decades, but I feel like the 80s had that crossover of a generation of you know, Kirby was still there and doing some work, and John Buscema was still doing work. You still had those creators who kind of built the industry and the art. You know, Neil Adams was still doing some things. but you also had John Byrne and George Perez and Walt Simonson, and then the list can go on and on and on about the writers and the works that they were doing, that it's still somewhat the gold standard for a lot of the seminal works, like Frank Miller's Daredevil is
Which, yeah, I was just going to bring that up. Yeah, exactly.
right, and you got Walt Simonson on Thor, and Swamp Thing by Alan Moore. The list goes on and on. Even some titles that you can maybe dismiss because somebody like a Superman is the old Boy Scout, kind of boring. But his run during the 80s as well had wonderful storytellers and artists telling those stories, and it's kind of always the benchmark that we go back to even today. But you can't really compare to Kirby and Stan and Ditko and what they did, because that's like the foundation. But when it comes to the design of the house, it feels like a lot of it was established in what those creators were doing in the 80s. It's like the greatest Hall of Fame era of creators all working and playing at a sport at the same time, that I don't know if you may ever see that again, or if it's just our nostalgia that makes us feel that way. I'm not sure.
Well, there was also like there were also great there was competition back then too. Like, I mean,
That's true. That's
you
true.
had Comico, right, with the Elementals, which Bill Willingham and like that had to be one of the best titles, the best stories on the market. And you also had like First Comics with all their crazy like Sargon and all those characters. Like they were different. They were they weren't mainstream. They weren't approved by the Comics Code Authority at that point, and which gave the incentive, I think, to the big publishers that we really don't need to curtail our work on the basis of a 1950s organization that was created during the Red Menace. So I think there was a time of experimentation. There was a time of growth, and there were alternatives. Like there was so. I mean, we saw like the creations of, like the Teenage Mutant Ninja
Yeah,
Turtles,
I was just
which
thinking that
really
too.
basically like told people that there were comic artists out there that didn't really take themselves that seriously, just enjoyed what they did, and that was refreshing. So I mean, you had the extremes with like the violent stuff and like the mature content with the Vertigo, but you even had like Captain Carrot and his amazing Zoo Crew, right? Like,
Absolutely.
I think there was just such a lot of variety, and again, you're right. Like, not to take away from the work that's being done today, but there was something special about the 80s. There was like this, like there were new discoveries, new realizations of what they could do, and it was kind of like a golden decade, I would say.
Yeah, I think so too. A lot of people sometimes look back and they might say, well, the comics weren't really that good back then as they are now. But maybe the way that they were being written and published to a particular age group, or the fact that now, comics are basically being made to collect in a bound volume at some point in time and read the story that way. You got a lot more bang for your buck back then. You could read a 2-issue, like Days of Future Past was 2 issues.
Two issues.
And
Yep, that's probably a great story.
the amount of story that you get in those 2 issues is incredible. Whereas now that would be dragged out to 12.
Well, and it had so many ramifications for the X-Men too, and it created more stories because everybody then became aware of that alternate future timeline. And again, like that was a concept, I think, that was kind of new at the time, was the idea of alternate timelines. And it was those comics that set the foundation, for books like Old Man Logan and Old Man Hawkeye. Because now writers have that freedom to explore storylines in different universes and different futures. And that's all because of Days of Future Past.
Yeah, it's
I
true.
miss the miniseries. I miss Magic. I was just explaining Magic to my daughter, because she has a friend called Ileana, who's a cool kid, but I still like Ileana is one of my all-time favorite characters. Whenever I go to a convention looking for art, I try to get a commission of Ileana, and still trying to push Bill Sienkiewicz to draw one for me. Throw that out there. Throw that out there. But she's just one of those characters. And I mean, four issues to tell this story about how this kid ages unnaturally in a matter of seconds, to the point where, you know, she has sorceress powers, but she's also developed her mutant powers at that point, which makes her, you know, a candidate for the New Mutants.
Yeah.
So, you know, a great spring off from that point, from a four-issue series that wasn't, you know, thought to, you know, that at the time to have, you know, any relevance other than just being a cool story. But it's stories like that, or, you know, Beauty and the Beast, you know, with the Beast and, blanking on...
Wonder Man? Is it Wonder Man?
No, it's... No. Oh, what's her name? Oh, my gosh. Blanking on a mutant. Singer.
Okay.
Dazzler.
There you go. Dazzler.
Yeah, and then you have, like, the Wolverine and the Gambit series and you know, or the Asgardian Wars.
Right.
Right? With the crossover between Alpha Flight and X-Men. And, like, there's just so many... great things that happened in the 80s that you know became like the launching points for stories today. Like, I know Matthew Rosenberg told me that he has, you know, he used to have a stack of his brother's X-Men and he would like read them religiously, and so you know that's affected the writers of today. You know, that's just one example.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. The miniseries is probably, I'd probably prefer the miniseries as opposed to the event. I think the event is overused and ruins a lot of storytelling potential that you could be getting out of writers because they've got to tie into an event, whereas a miniseries was always a good springboard of where they could take something. Because I remember reading in Inferno, they just recently released that in one of those milestone trades of the X-Men. I had never read Inferno before. It just seemed so daunting and big, and you needed to know so much. But there's a lot of key storytelling moments in the history of the X-Universe. But there was that one miniseries in there. I forget the name of it now, but it was of the four young children. It was from Louise Simonson and...
Power Pack.
I don't think it was Power Pack. It was something else. Power Pack, yeah, but all of those characters joined New Mutants afterwards. I think Richter was introduced there. I forgot the name of it now, but it tied in with
There was Fallen Angels.
Oh, I can't remember. We're both forgetting things today.
I'm getting old.
but it was one of those stories where I was like, do I have to read the New Mutants issues for this? And as it went along, and I said, okay, let me. Be a completionist and do it. You're right. The Ileana arc was so pivotal to that story, where even the books that you may not have wanted to read at that time paid off. There was a payoff to it, and that's something that I don't know if it was the decade and how comics were presented then, but now because things kind of restart so much, you don't know how much things actually count. Whereas back then, you still feel like those stories count for some reason.
Well, and I think also the, you know, proliferation of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and, you know, the DC movies and stuff, it's obviously created a desire to go back and read those stories because, you know, a lot of those films, you know, pay homage to those creators and, you know, they're listed in their credits and, I mean, you know, you can't count the amount of times that Bob Layton has gone to an Iron Man premiere, right? And, there's so much that is owed to that, but even though it's presented in a different way, that's more current, more timely. You know, there's still that desire to go back and read the original stories, which you know is a great thing. I think that's very valuable for those creators to get you know that attention.
Yeah, absolutely. The miniseries I remember now, Exterminators. 1-4.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna throw a couple of this or that's to you before we finish here. I just want to get your hot take on which you prefer of artists and writers from that bygone era. So, okay. John Byrne or George Perez?
Oh, this is hard because you know, met them both, but Burns always been my guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Perez, I love George, and again, the warmth, the compassion, the sheer niceness. John was the first American. John's work was the first American comic I'd ever read when I came to Canada,
Yeah.
and his work has stuck with me ever since I was a kid. I have everything by him, and was really, really lucky to interview him and to hang out with him at Boston and Toronto,
That's awesome.
and yeah, to have actually a funny story about John. I actually brought Brent Spiner over to meet him. And had this great picture of Brent Spiner going, "Hi, did you ever draw me?" And of course, John's a big Star Trek fan. That was a good moment. But yeah, I would have to go with Byrne.
It's a tough one, but yeah, I understand. Yeah, it's an understandable answer. How about Miller or Simonson?
Again, interviewed them both. I'd go with Walt. The thing I can't criticize Frank Miller, so I won't. But Walt's work is based on something that he and I both share. He has this love for Norse culture and Norse mythology, and I did my English studies in Old English. So that's been a shared story value, and the way that he brought the Marvel Norse to life was, a real like hearkening back to those original Norse designs, and I love Walt Simonson's work.
Yeah, his Thor run is one of the most beautiful things that I ever had a chance to look at and read. I absolutely
Yeah,
love it.
and I have a great story about Walt that would really just, break your heart. Like, he's just such a loving, I can't say enough good about Walt Simonson.
Yeah, I would love to be able to meet him one day. Because between him and his wife, they both have contributed so much to the medium. Kirby or Ditko?
I was never a Kirby fan. I know that's going to sound heretical, but
A lot of people say that. A lot of people say that.
I know. I was never a fan of Kirby's work. So I'd go with Ditko.
Okay. Yeah, it's funny. A lot of people say that, and even people who turn out to love Kirby always start off saying, "I didn't like his work," but it's I love all of the sons of Jack Kirby. Like I look at Walt Simonson's work, I look at John Byrne's work, and I see why, like the things that they do to emulate or pay respects to him. But I get the aesthetic of I don't like Kirby, but everyone kind of borrows from him. It's a very interesting thing.
Actually, I remember, like, this is funny because I remember he was one of the first artists, that I had read when I was young. And I remember looking at his art and thinking how blockish it was. And I mean, this is a child's memory, right? And then I of course, you've got to pay, your respects to Kirby. I mean, who wouldn't? He's a master visual storyteller. And it would be wrong if I didn't acknowledge that. However, I just was not a fan of his art, and it's, I guess, that secret is now out, but I think I preferred curves and softer figures as opposed to I think the first comic I ever read of him was Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen. And I just remember looking at the knuckles on Superman and thinking, those are like gorilla's knuckles. Like, I just couldn't get into it.
Yeah, no, I get it. I've had that same reaction to Kirby's work too, but then there's something about it that's grown on me, and I don't know if it's from through other artists that I've learned to appreciate his work. So
Yeah,
I'll have to consider that.
I think for me, the way I appreciate Kirby's work is the fact that it's so out there. It was like for the time, it was like, again, going back to that idea of the extreme of imagination, like the fifth world. Like, I mean, it's just stuff that the new gods, like the guy created an entirely new, cosmology.
Yeah, it's
And
incredible.
he had that capacity to go out and not only, describe it, but he could visually describe it. So, I mean, yeah, like not taking away from the guy's talent, not saying he didn't have talent, but yeah, it was just something I just didn't appreciate.
Yeah, I get it. One more. Romita or Buscema? Is this the stumper?
Yeah, that's a stickler.
No wrong answers here, John.
Yeah, I know. I think I'd have to. Oh, yeah, that's hard. John or Sal?
For me? Are you
No,
asking?
I was going to say like John Buscema or Sal Buscema.
John, I'm
John
this is
Buscema.
the battle of the Johns for John.
Oh yeah. Okay, I'll go with John.
Good answer. Good answer. No wrong answers there. Oh, that's good. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate your time. I hope we could do this again because there's a lot of insights that you got, and I'd love to hear that Walt Simonson story one day.
He's a beautiful man. He really is.
Where can people follow your work? What websites and things have you written lately that people can check you out?
Well, I've just written. I've just done an interview with Joel McHale from Community about his latest movie, Becky, which is the story of a teenage female Rambo, basically, who protects her family when they get home invaded in their cottage. It's a really great film. He plays Becky's dad. That's going to be coming out on Friday, I think, on forcesofgeek.com. And I think I'll also be doing another article about that interview for Pop Mythology.
Okay.
I've written for TrekCore.com. There's a lot of Star Trek interviews and comic reviews on there. And just where else have I written? Oh, Back Issue Magazine, of course. I'm writing a Sergeant Rock article for Back Issue. And if we get the go ahead to go with Fan Expo, well, I guess you'll see me moderate there as well.
Let's hope so. I was just gonna say, I hope Fan Expo, there's a hope that it could happen. And if it does, I look forward to seeing you there and attending one of your panels. And in the meanwhile, I hope you and your family stay safe and healthy. And thank you again
Thank
for
you.
doing this.
Thank you, you too.
All right, thanks so much, John. You have a good night, and we will talk soon.